This is Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest. Welcome to another edition of the Three Questions podcast. I've decided to do something again a little bit different today, and I apologize to everyone who prefers my having guests to my just talking myself. But I thought I would talk today for a few minutes about foreign policy realism. The Center for the National Interest defines itself as a home for foreign policy realism. And it occurs to me that not everyone may be familiar with that approach to making foreign policy. Some may have their own views about it. So today I'm going to share my perspective on it. And, you know, this is really just my perspective. It's not institutional perspective, and it's certainly not meant to be some kind of defining view. This is just me sharing my thoughts about what foreign policy realism means to me. But I will do it in the three questions format, answering three questions. So the first question for myself, you know, what is foreign policy realism? As I think about that, I say, first of all, foreign policy realism is not international relations theory realism. The two things are, I think, closely related in a number of respects, but one of them is sort of a practical framework and tool for making policy, while the other is an effort to build a theoretical model to explain why states do the things that they do. So first point, not talking about realist IR theory, talking about realism as a school of foreign policy thinking and practice. Secondly, I really think about realism as being, in this sense, as being defined fundamentally by three things. One is a clear understanding of power and power relationships, because power matters in international affairs. Secondly, is an appreciation of strategy. And thirdly, is a pragmatic approach. I view those three components as really being kind of, for me, again, you know, defining components of realism: power, strategy, and pragmatism. And to give just one brief example, I wrote a long essay for the National Interest, the center's publication, many years ago, arguing that then President Barack Obama was not a realist, although, you know, many described him as such, because I felt that President Obama certainly had a clear strategy and was also prepared to be quite pragmatic. But I don't think he had a clear appreciation of power and the role that power plays in international affairs. Because, as I argued in that article, President Obama kind of put too much emphasis and perhaps even too much faith in international institutions, rules, norms, structures, international law, these various other concepts, which, you know, are all important, but I think for many realists exist primarily and can be enforced primarily because of power relationships, not because of their own sort of inherent value. So anyway, what is realism? That's my answer. Second question, what are some of the key principles of realism? And let me say here, actually, I have sort of a very big tent approach, I guess, where realism is concerned. I view it really as a sort of a framework for thinking and talking about foreign affairs, and not so much a list of particular positions, you know, that one should take on specific issues. Because I think that two people who follow this approach, they may well have different policy recommendations to deal with the same issue because they may have different judgments about what's likely to work or not work, or what the costs or benefits of a particular approach might be. The point is, however, that they'll have a common analytical framework and a way of talking to one another about these challenges that will, I think, allow for useful exchange. In any event, key principles, and I just alluded to a couple of them in my sort of interstitial comment there. The first being the idea of costs and benefits. This is sort of a central part of any realist approach, I think. What are the costs of a particular course of action? What are the likely benefits of that course of action? And I think this is language that we sort of frequently hear realists use. Secondly, I think many realists, because they think a lot about power, they understand that power, you know, in all its forms, military, economic, technological, diplomatic, there are many other kinds of power. Realists understand that power is limited, that even a wealthy country like the United States has limited resources. And because power is limited, there are constraints. And these constraints are one of the things that make pragmatism actually quite important. And that sort of leads very nicely into a third principle that I think many realists share, which is the idea that we have to set priorities. When we have limited resources and we can't do everything we want to do, we should do the things that are most important to us. And, you know, some people might say, well, our limits aren't as great as you might think, or we can achieve sort of multiple objectives through a single course of action, and therefore we should do that. President George W. Bush and some of his supporters, when he was in office, had the view that our interests and values were identical and there were no trade-offs between the two. I think, you know, history at this point has fairly convincingly demonstrated that actually there were trade-offs. People who are interested in my talking more about that, let me know. We can focus a subsequent conversation on that point. There are a lot of other principles, but I'm just going to, that I think many realists share, but I'm just going to highlight one other one right now for the sake of brevity here. And that's the idea of unintended consequences. And perhaps more broadly, that we can't really know how things will end when we start pursuing a particular course of action. And realists, I think, are generally speaking quite mindful of this problem in international affairs and try to spend a lot of time thinking through how a particular problem or set of problems might evolve over time in order to try to actually minimize the impact of potential unintended consequences. There's kind of a distressing tendency among many who are not realists to see a problem somewhere in American foreign policy or somewhere in the world, and to kind of jump from problem to solution rather quickly without thinking of the effects that their preferred solution might actually have in the real world. And that can include unintended consequences of our action or second or third order impacts. But it can also include, by the way, how others react to actions that we take, because particularly in dealing with our adversaries, but, you know, not only in dealing with our adversaries, certainly also in dealing with allies and friends, the other side gets a vote And it's usually a mistake to think that we can see a problem and take an action and then the problem is solved. Because what is much more common is that we see a problem and we take an action and then others see our action and respond to our action. And we have to ask ourselves, will we be sort of better off or worse off? And will the problem that we're trying to solve actually be solved, actually after others respond to whatever we may choose to do? And after we respond to that and they respond to our response, and, you know, this is, you know, an idea that comes through in concepts like the escalation spiral, or although it can obviously take other forms. The final question that I'll address today on foreign policy realism is morality. This is a question that's often brought up in debates between realists and others coming from, you know, maybe a different school of thought. Is it possible to have a realist foreign policy? Is realism a moral approach? How can we have a moral foreign policy if we spend so much time thinking about power? And let me say a couple of things here, because I think we see these debates play out in a few different areas. One of them has been in American efforts to promote democracy over the last three decades since the end of the Cold War, which I think we can now say those efforts in retrospect, at least from the point of view that we have today in late 2025, have not been resoundingly successful. And, you know, if we look back at the history of the Cold War, which, you know, by the way, many of the senior officials over the last 30 years were responding to and taking the approach that they took to promoting democracy. There was a feeling among some, and this was certainly pronounced during the Bush administration, that the United States had sided with dictators during the Cold War and that that was bad. American strategy during the Cold War, as some may know, was largely founded on a document known as NSC 68, a White House National Security Council document that set out the foundations of what became the containment strategy for the United States in dealing with the Soviet Union. And I think it's interesting to go back to that document today and look at it with the perspective that we have, you know, from 2025, looking back, you know, many, many decades at NSC 68, you know, from the 1950s. And I think there's an interesting statement buried in there, which I'll quote now directly and very briefly. In relations between nations, the prime reliance of the free society is on the strength and appeal of its idea, and it feels no compulsion sooner or later to bring all societies into conformity with it. So this is the idea that the United States really should serve as an example to others rather than trying to impose its own sort of views of how others should run their country on them. I happen to think, first of all, that that was a pretty sound approach to the Cold War that allowed the United States to prevail. And I'm not sure that I think it's less clear that the United States could have prevailed with a different approach, among other reasons, because taking that approach allowed us to position ourselves diplomatically as defenders of the status quo and to position the Soviets as people who were trying to overthrow the status quo. I think that had a lot to do with how America was able to build the large and ultimately victorious coalition that it built. Secondly, however, people in the United States want and value freedom. People in other countries want and value freedom. The first freedom, I think, however, that we and others want is actually freedom from interference by people who live in other countries. This is why governments actually exist in the first place, because people living in one place wanted people living in a different place to leave them alone. So I think efforts to try to have too great voice in how others pursue their own affairs actually, first of all, go against thousands of years of human civilization and human nature. But secondly, you know, fairly quickly impinge on the freedom that we should want others to have to manage their own affairs as they see fit. Secondly, I think there's kind of a different point that I'd make on morality. And this is something that, you know, we see, I think, more and more in the United States and elsewhere as the media become globalized and social media take really a dominant role as the global public square and the American public square. And this is sort of the distinction between saying things that sound very moral and actually doing things that are moral, that have moral outcomes. So I would make a distinction between the morality of one's intent and the morality of the result. We have in English this saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And there's a reason that that saying exists. And the reason is that having moral intent isn't always good enough. In fact, it's often not good enough, because intent isn't enough to produce outcomes. It, you know, whether you're talking about morality or anything else, there's a real world with a lot of real people and their preferences and values and priorities, and they're all competing. And having good intent kind of isn't enough to get the outcome that one might want. And sometimes it's even counterproductive. And here I would just quote actually George Kennan very briefly. And some may be familiar with Kennan as the architect of the Cold War containment strategy that I referred to just a few minutes ago here. He's also, I think, known as a very incisive realist thinker. And Kennan had the following to say. He was complaining about something that he called the histrionics of moralism. And then Kennan says, quote, "By that I mean the projection of attitudes, poses, and rhetoric that cause us to appear noble and altruistic in the mirror of our own vanity, but lack substance when related to the realities of international life. It is a sad feature," Kennan wrote, "a sad feature of the human predicament in personal as in public life, that whenever one has the agreeable sensation of being impressively moral, one probably is not. What one does without self-consciousness or self-admiration as a matter of duty or common decency is apt to be closer to the real thing." That's the end of the quote. And here we get to people saying perhaps very moralistic things on social media, or maybe one would prefer that the president says very, very moralistic things. But did these actually produce outcomes that make a material difference? Did they even, in some cases, help at all? And I think that's a real question. The final point I would make is that morality is sort of rarely as black and white as we might prefer it to be. So, for example, to invent a case, let's say that you have a terrible dictator in power. There's a popular uprising against the terrible dictator, and there's a vicious and brutal civil war. We have, again, let's simplify it, two options. One option is to try to negotiate an exit for that terrible dictator. and to let that individual leave the country where he or she is in power and to go to Switzerland or some other place internationally to take a lot of the accumulated loot of the dictatorial regime and to live a comfortable life. And then the civil war ends. The people who back that individual are kind of taken care of as part of the deal. And you have a solution that brings peace and saves a lot of lives, but there is no justice. And then you have option B, where you pursue justice and try to get that person kind of captured and imprisoned and tried in The Hague. And you try to support the opposition forces until they achieve a military victory. And that takes another 3 years. And another 100,000 people die. And because of that, the supporters of this ousted leader don't really fully buy in to the new society. And there's continuing instability and violence for years to come. But you get rid of the terrible dictator, and that individual faces justice and is punished. Which of those outcomes is more moral? Again, this is sort of a more simplistic case. We could make it a little more textured. The point is to illustrate that these calculations are actually calculations, and moral calculus is inherently subjective. The point here is that most moral questions are not easily divided into black and white. And in fact, there are, you know, in the real world, usually a lot of shades of gray. And what realists want to do is to have policies that work, that produce outcomes that succeed. And I think in most cases, it's going to be actually better to have a policy so that succeeds than a policy that fails, and that the moral calculus of that policy will be much more favorable than the moral calculus of a policy that doesn't work, even if it may have been more well-intentioned or nobly expressed. In any event, I hope this was a helpful perspective. Again, it's just my perspective, but I hope an interesting point of view on foreign policy realism. And if I hear any expressions of interest from out there, can do more similar episodes in the future. Thank you so much for joining me again today, Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest and the Three Questions podcast. Thank you.